On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with UFO filmmaker Paul Kimball.
I step back and I say, whoa, who's the paranormalist in chief? I had this dialogue with a friend of mine who's a liberal Democrat in the United States. He was going on and on and on about how we have to elect Barack Obama. And I was going, yeah, sure, absolutely. I agree with you. But he was also, he was a guy who continually would chide me about my interest in the paranormal. And I said, well, wait a second now. You're telling me that you're going to vote for a guy.
Hold on, Paul, because I love that. It's in the introduction of your book. Here's the quote that he gave to Christianity Today. I am a Christian. I am a devout Christian. I believe in the redemptive death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I believe faith gives me a path to be cleansed of sin and have eternal life.
You know, I'm kind of looking at it too, and I'll just read. So I write, so I asked my friend the next time I saw him after the election, let me get this straight. You just voted in an election for the most powerful office in the world for a man who believes in a supernatural being with whom he communicates via telepathy. This supernatural being also sent his only son to Earth to be tortured and executed, and then brought him back from the dead a couple of days later, all so that a prophecy could be fulfilled. And of course, there's the whole walking on water thing, not to mention the water into wine trick, the raising of the dead. I could have mentioned the virgin birth, but I didn't, and on and on and on. And the point to me is, the materialist world that we live in now, it's become very sort of de rigueur to just dismiss all of this stuff. And I understand why, but you should be able to separate organized religion from what's actually out there. Call it spirituality, call it faith, call it philosophy, if you will.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, you're going to meet someone who has an interesting journey into the paranormal, many aspects of the paranormal. He started out as a UFO filmmaker, but as you'll hear, he's broadened that interest to many aspects of the paranormal. Here's my interview with Paul Kimball. Today we welcome filmmaker Paul Kimball to Skeptico. Paul has written a fascinating new book titled The Other Side of Truth, in which he takes us on a road trip of sorts through all sorts of questions about ghosts, extraterrestrials, reincarnation, and the afterlife. Quite a fascinating book. Paul, welcome, and thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Alex. Good to be here. Long-time listener, first-time guest, as they say on some other sort of radio shows. So great to be here talking to the Skeptico audience.
Great. Well, that's great to hear. As you know, I love the opportunity for kind of the cross-fertilization, if you will, because I think there's so many opportunities when we kind of look beyond the narrow field that we focus on. And that narrowness is necessary, right? To really understand something, we have to focus on it. But then it's nice to kind of back up and look at the bigger picture, which is certainly something that you've done in this book. Now, even though you're probably best known as a documentary filmmaker, films like Best Evidence, a film about UFOs and the best UFO cases, and a biopic that I really enjoyed titled Stanton Friedman is Real. I love the way it starts out with him on the pulpit and you have almost like organ church music in the background. I thought that was really well done.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I've been criticized actually by a number of people over the years. That was made almost 12 years ago. A number of people criticized me for the use of the organ music. And I said, well, you know, Stan Friedman is in many ways a flying saucer evangelist. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, but that's what he does. He goes out and he spreads the gospel of flying saucerdom as he sees it. And so it was a little cheeky, but you find out pretty quick that people on either extreme of any intellectual divide are singularly devoid of any sense of humor. So, you know, that was my first experience with the people who were on the far extremes of sort of the UFO subculture. And yeah, they didn't get it. But most of the people in Canada and elsewhere who watched the film, who are not particularly obsessed with UFOs, but just wanted to see an interesting film, at least I think it's interesting, about an interesting guy. And there's no question, whether you agree with him or not, Friedman is a very interesting man who's lived a very interesting life, then they enjoyed the film. But, you know, the people that sort of believe that aliens from Zeta Reticuli are coming here and harvesting our our genetic material or whatever, they were less enthused. But fortunately, filmmakers don't make their films for particular audiences. They make them for everyone.
So from that, you've kind of ventured into something different with this book, much broader, much more of this journey and encompassing a lot of different paranormal, if you will, that's the term you always use, phenomena. What were you trying to accomplish here?
Well, the mistake a lot of folks have made, my mom sort of drilled it into me when I was writing the book. She said, you know, you're probably all, until you make a Spielbergian feature film hit, which I'm working on, but you're probably always going to be known for the UFO films you did, despite the fact that the majority of my work as a filmmaker has had nothing to do with the paranormal. I did two seasons of a television series for Bravo about classical music. I've done documentaries about music and art and all sorts of other subjects. But some of them had to do with UFOs. And then I did a season of a show about ghosts. So, you know, my interests have always been far broader than the paranormal. And I wanted, but I'm interested in the paranormal. So I thought, well, look, I've written this blog for years, sort of about the paranormal, but sort of about, you know, the world that I live in my own views about various things. Why don't I try and bring all those together and also bring together my own past, some of my own experiences, but not just as it relates to the paranormal, but as it relates to my entertainment career. Before I was in the film industry, I was a musician back. Folks in the United States might or might not remember this, but in Canada, it was a big thing. We were known as the Seattle of the East Coast in the 1990s, Halifax, the big Halifax pop explosion in Canada. And so I was playing sort of rock and pop music in the midst of that. And like I said, a lot of my filmmaking has dealt with music. So I've always had this broad interest in art and music and all sorts of things. So I thought, well, look, why don't I just put them all into one big pot, stew it around, and see what comes out, see if there's some sort of relationship between all of it. And weirdly enough, as I sort of figured out, to me at least, there seems to be some sort of relationship to it, which is kind of why the subtitle of the book is the, I have to make sure I get this right, The Paranormal, The Art of the Imagination and the Human Condition, which is something else that I've always been very concerned about. Even before I was into music and film, my undergraduate degree is in history and political science, and I have a law degree. So I was always very concerned about politics, about what was going on in the world around me. So all of those things, I mean, and you talked at the very beginning about people having broad interests. You know, it is good to focus, but I really, the book actually has a phrase that I kind of take to heart as a motto for my life, which is the journey is the destination. And I think people often get too focused on the destination. It's like driving on an interstate from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. And all you can do is think about getting to Las Vegas. Well, you miss some interesting things along the way, including a really good Greek restaurant. I think it's in Barstow. But, you know, if you're not willing to look at what's around you as you're focusing in on that destination, you're going to miss everything else. And so what I wanted to do was create a book that kind of didn't just focus on a destination, but actually looked at the journey.
Okay, so enjoy the journey, but I have to jump to the conclusion. What did you find out? What was the big takeaway from the journey?
Well, yeah, this will probably drive people nuts, but the takeaway from the journey, I guess, is that I'm still on the journey. But if you know, the overarching theory, which I think, sort of hesitate to call it a theory because I know that annoys people, but I will. The overarching theory is that there is an advanced non-human intelligence interacting with us, has been interacting with us through all of human history. I don't say where it's from. I don't say what it is. I don't even actually say that I firmly, completely, absolutely believe that this is true. I just say, this is what I'm going to assume for the sake of argument. And now I'm going to make, you know, the argument based on that. And that there's three sort of possibilities when you look at this advanced non-human intelligence interacting with us. It could either mean us harm, it could either mean us good in a positive sense, or it could mean, you know, benign neglect. I heard Michio Kaku give a lecture at the RSA in London in 2009, which I refer to in the book. And he basically said that we are ants as to, you know, any advanced non-human intelligences, humans, that sort of relationship. So it's not that they mean us harm, or it's not that they, you know, mean to do us any good. It's just they don't even really notice we're here, and we have no way of interacting with them, just as ants really have no way of interacting with us, at least in his view.
Let's go back to Michio Kaku, because you have a great passage in the book. I think you really nailed this. When you say that maybe the mistake that he's made is in seeing us in this anthill and seeing that there's no way that any message that this higher intelligence could be giving us could get through to us, and it's broken up into little million little pieces. And then you say from the book, the mistake that Kaku might have made, however, is seeing the message as something for us or about us or beyond us, when it may well be that the message is us. Perhaps we are the information, and slowly over the course of time, the message is being reassembled into its whole. Hey, pretty deep stuff there. Really great stuff, but pretty deep. Talk about that for a second.
Well, there's two things that I take out of that. The first thing is, and I talk about this briefly in the book, humans actually do take an interest in ants. They can actually communicate with ants. I know because I do this myself. And I talk about myself as a younger man, sort of being the ant Satan, where I would fry them, much, you know, I hate to admit it. I would fry them, you know, under the magnifying glass. I think all young boys might have done that at some point or another. So if you're an ant, you would be looking up at me and go, ah, where is this coming from? This is this horrible ant Satan. Not that they would phrase it that way, but I was bad. Now I'm more of the ant or the, you know, the god scientist of ants. I'll look down as I'm walking on. If I notice them, I'll watch their little behavior. I find them quite fascinating. So, you know, in that sense, I think Kaku was wrong that you can't communicate. Even if you're at that gulf, you can't communicate. But then he used an he continued on and he said, well, look, we're listening to them using SETI radio signals. We're trying to see UFOs or whatever it is that we're trying to figure out. This is how we view extraterrestrials or an advanced non-human intelligence. But what if it's something so much more interesting than that? So they would be communicating, they could be thousands or millions of years in advance of us using technologies that we would call magic. It's not even a science that we would understand. And so they're communicating in all sorts of different ways. And then he broke it down and used the example of email. He said, email was developed for military applications, you know, so that if there was a massive attack, the information could be split up and then reassembled. And I didn't really think of it at the time, but I said, well, wait a second now. What if we are the information? You know, and this gets into the kinds of things, at least to me, I think it gets into the kinds of things that you've talked about consciousness, about our relationship to ourselves, but also to all the people around us, but to the universe as a whole. And I said, well, Kaku might be right, but for the wrong reasons. You know, he's talking about it in terms of a very simplistic, if you want to look at it that way, just using the emails as an example. But what if you took that and you extended that even further and said, well, wait a second, there is a form of communication going on. We're part of it. We are it.
As you may know, I had a chance to talk with fellow Canadian, Grant Cameron, a while back, and he's someone who's dug deeply into UFO research and come out and said, wow, it's all about this consciousness thing. And he isn't saying it from a theoretical basis. He's saying, hey, the evidence, when I look at what I've uncovered, the insiders have told us that it's about this consciousness thing. Why is it so hard for many folks in the UFO community to approach these topics in a broader sense of consciousness, or even, dare I say, spiritual? Because there is a certain spirituality that you bring to your book as well. Even though it doesn't mention it explicitly very often, you have no problem weaving together, you know, transcendent spiritual experiences from people like Christian mystic Henry Allen. You have no problem talking about people who have this belief in this relationship with God. You just very smoothly weave all that stuff together in a way that a lot of folks in the UFO community just can't seem to get to. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I'll preface it by saying that I've never considered myself a UFO researcher, nor have I any desire to ever be considered as a UFO researcher. Good for them, but it's not, you know, where I like to be pigeonholed. I don't like to be pigeonholed anywhere. You've read the book, Alex. I think that should be pretty clear.
Sure, but touch on that for a minute, Paul, before we move on. What about your experience as a filmmaker, as a presenter, holds you back from saying you're not a UFO researcher? What do you think that there's obviously a distinction there that I think is worth making and you're making, but let's be explicit about it. What's the difference between you and a UFO researcher?
Sure. Two things. One, at least I think two things. I mean, you know, I made a film about classical music. I don't consider myself a classical musician. So when I was making, I'd like to, I'm just not that talented. But so when I'm putting out films about folks who have researched, who have particular views, I've always believed the documentarian, yes, you have a point of view. It's impossible to not have a subjective, have the subjective point of view of the filmmaker drift into the film, no matter how hard you try not to do it. But I've always gone to great pains to be as objective as possible, to prevent, or to present both sides of the argument, to the point where nobody I've ever interviewed, I've never had a complaint from anybody I've ever interviewed, whether you call them skeptics or disbelievers or true believers or whatever, in the UFO stuff, about how I presented their views. I've always given them a fair shake. So I think that's part of it. I also, you know, the idea of, I just don't do that kind of research. I don't dig through archives. I don't go out and interview witnesses. I have talked to, obviously, people in the field, but I don't, it's not something that obsesses me. It's just a very small part when I step back from the actual work of doing films that might involve UFOs, what my life is. You know, UFOs in the, is just a very small part of it. So, you know, Grant, for instance, Grant, it's a very large part of his life. And so, and he's dug through archives and made Freedom of Information Act requests and all that sort of stuff. I think he can legit, whether you agree with him or not, he can legitimately say to be, he's a researcher of the UFO subject, like Stan Friedman can and some other people. Then there's the rest of us who are more commenters, or if you want to, bards in the sort of medieval way. We tell their stories. We give them the opportunity to present their research, and then folks can make up their own mind. So yeah, that's why I don't, you know, consider myself a UFO researcher, just because I'm not. But somebody like Grant Cameron is. The different, you know, the difference is, I think it does allow people like me, or like my friends Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop, to, who are also writers and observers of the UFO scene and the paranormal scene, to step back and view it more objectively, which I think gets back to the question that you had asked before about spirituality and stuff. I think it allows us to take a broader view. And, you know, Nick, for those folks who don't know, Nick Redfern has written a wide range of books on everything from Bigfoot and sea monsters to UFOs. The UFO community hates the Bigfoot community in the sense that it's like, well, there can't be any relationship between the two. There can't be any relationship between ghosts. This is just within paranormal stuff. There can't be any relationship between ghosts and UFOs. It's all separate. Then if you broaden it out and you say, well, okay, let's leave that part of the paranormal and let's talk about spirituality or consciousness. Oh, good heavens, no. We don't want to talk about Bigfoot or ghosts. We definitely don't want to talk about consciousness. What we want to talk about, the majority meme within the UFO subculture has been extraterrestrials coming to Earth from a, you know, planet Zeta Reticuli or whatever, in nuts and bolts, flying saucers. And it hasn't really changed. That narrative hasn't really changed since the 1950s, when it was very much informed by the sort of science fiction culture that people were living in at the time. The, not just science fiction, but also the science culture, you know, the advent of the atomic age and all that sort of stuff. So it's very, very much rooted in something that happened 60 years ago. And the majority of people within the UFO subculture haven't changed a great deal. There are exceptions to that rule. Somebody like Jacques Vallée is a very good exception. Vallée began in the 60s as sort of very much a nuts and bolts ufology kind of guy. And he left that behind very quickly. And he brought his scientific training and his very sort of broad interest and looked at it in a much more holistic kind of way. So there are people like Vallée out there. I think there are more of them now than there used to be. But generally speaking, those people don't associate with the sort of nuts and bolts crowd of UFO researchers, because they just don't find them very interesting. The material that they cull to a point is interesting, but actually getting into, you know, just it inevitably leads to fights and arguments and flame wars on the internet or whatever. And I think people who take a broader view of it, call them agnostics, if you will, don't really have any time for that. Whether it's coming from the sort of arch disbeliever side or whether it's coming from the arch true believer side. So different sides of the same coin for those of us that sit in what my friend Greg Bishop has called the excluded middle.
You know, I'm not sure on that point. I totally agree with you, because I think that there's a huge difference between accepting a reality to the UFO phenomena and rejecting and denying a reality to the UFO phenomena. And I think there's more of a parallel between deniers of different stripes, if you will, than there is between, you know, the two sides of the same coin, the radical UFO believer and the radical UFO denier. Do you know what I mean on that?
I do. For me, you know, and, you know, the spirituality thing is a good example. I'm an agnostic when it comes to questions of faith or spirituality or whatever tag you want to put on it. I look at both sides. I could look at Tim LaHaye, who wrote the horrible Left Behind novels about the post-apocalyptic end of the world. And on one hand, and I can look at Richard Dawkins on the other hand, and I can say, well, you know what? There's both of them have something that I can find remotely interesting. But to me, it's like when I deal with those folks, it's like walking into a bar and I apologize in advance if this sounds a little sexist, but you can flip it around. But I'm a guy, so I'm going to use the guy example. A guy walks into a bar, sees a bar full of women, and he sees two other guys standing in a bar, and they are consistently looking at only that one woman. And they're both trying to get her, and they're both presenting their best case, and they're both arguing over her, and they're fighting and all that sort of stuff. And I don't care, because there's a bar full of, you know, other very interesting women. And if you're a woman walking in, you'd see a bar full of other interesting men. So that's what I look at, and I see people on the extremes of either side. And I honestly, I've spent enough time with the UFO true believers. Lord knows I've spent enough time with the UFO true believers to know. And I've spent, you know, enough time talking to the James Randi types, the PsyCop types, the disbelievers. And I really do. Once you talk to them at any length, you realize that they are both exactly the same. They're locked into this. It's like the old Star Trek episode from the original series where Lazarus shows up and there's the antimatter Lazarus and the matter Lazarus, or loci, even a better example, the two guys with different colors on different sides of the face, loci and whatever the police officer's name was. And they just can't get beyond their fight that's been going on for thousands of years. And no matter how hard Kirk and the Enterprise crew try to tell him, look, we'll take you back. You can live in the Federation. You can have a great life. You can move beyond that. They can't. And it led to the eventual destruction of the world. There's nothing that I've ever experienced that you can profit from getting involved in those conversations. And I think that's, I get where you're coming from. I absolutely understand. Frankly, if you put a gun to my head and said, would you rather spend time with the true believers of any stripe, whether it's UFOs or God or whatever, or the true disbelievers, I'll choose the true believers, because at least I think they're a little more, they're more fun, and they're just less churlish.
Yeah, I hear you on that. But since the book title is The Other Side of Truth, and you're true to that in what you just said, and I appreciate that. But I guess I want to get to nudging a little bit closer to the truth. And of course, that always throws people off, because there is no the truth. There is no ultimate truth. I mean, that's the reality that you've come to in your conclusion. It's about the journey. It's the reality that I've come to, that it is really about the journey. It's about our personal process. At the same time, in this enterprise you and I are engaged in here, there is, we're going to play this game that there is a truth, and we have to move a little bit closer to it. And in, sure, to that extent, there's this dialogue going on that's kind of dominating our culture, and it's this dialogue about what we are, about who we are. And I think the UFO phenomena has a definite take on that. If there's a reality to the UFO phenomena, it has a strong bearing, a strong influence on our understanding of who we are and what we are. And I'd say the same thing about, I hear you on the fundamentalist Christians, and they can be a real pain. But if we step back and we say, gee, if we had to judge, it looks like they are more right, more true, more real than our hardcore atheist skeptics over here. I mean, there's useful information there that I want to take away and use for my personal journey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the interesting thing to me, and I point this out in the book at the very beginning, I say that, and I'm just going to talk about the sort of hard line. They would call themselves skeptics. I really do like the term fundamentalist disbelievers. They look and they say, they use terms like Wu-meister. Oh, I hear that all the time. I think I've even seen that directed at you on occasion. No. You know, whatever the sort of pejorative terms, I know it's been directed at me, whatever the pejorative term, so we're in good company. So whatever the pejorative term is, I mean, people are so focused on bringing people down. And I step back and I say, whoa, whoa, whoa. who's the paranormalist in chief in, say, the United States right now? Well, and I had this dialogue with a friend of mine who's a liberal Democrat in the United States. Being a Canadian, I don't have very many friends who are conservative Republicans, so all my American friends are liberal Democrats. But he was going on and on and on about how we have to elect Barack Obama. And I was going, yeah, sure, absolutely, I agree with you. But he was a guy who continually would chide me about my interest in the paranormal. And he would occasionally call it, you know, woo and all that sort of stuff, because he's very big into the James Randi kind of stuff. And so one day we're sitting there and we're talking about both of these things. And I said, well, wait a second now. You're telling me that you're going to go vote. You're going to mark an X or however, I don't know which, you know, what his state does, hanging chads or whatever, but you're going to vote for a guy who has stated repeatedly that he believes in God, this sort of telepathic, being.
Oh, hold on, Paul, because I love that. It's in the introduction of your book, and I have the exact quote that you include in the book, and it's really good because this is in a 2008 interview between Christianity Today, consider the source here, and Barack Obama. And what I'd love to do is I've always, since I read this quote in your book, this is a little aside, but I've always had this fantasy of walking up to people on the street, you know, with a camera, your kind of thing, a documentarian, and giving people this quote and not telling them who it's from, and then having them pick, you know, from the various candidates out there, from the right-wing, most ardent Christian to Barack Obama. And no one would properly credit this to Barack Obama, but that's too much of an aside. Here's the quote that he gave to Christianity Today. I am a Christian. I am a devout Christian. I believe in the redemptive death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I believe faith gives me a path to be cleansed of sin and have eternal life.
Right. And so, you know, I'm kind of looking at it too, and I'll just read, you know, what my reaction was, because I think it was much pithier at the time than I might remember now. So I write, so I asked my friend the next time I saw him after the election, let me get this straight. You just voted in an election for the most powerful office in the world, for a man who believes in a supernatural being with whom he communicates via telepathy. This supernatural being also sent his only son to Earth to be tortured and executed, and then brought him back from the dead a couple of days later, all so that a prophecy could be fulfilled. And of course, there's the whole walking on water thing, not to mention the water into wine trick, the raising of the dead. I could have mentioned the virgin birth, but I didn't, and on and on and on. And so, you know, I remember the conversation very well. I paused for effect, my friend began to frown, and I delivered the punchline. And you think I'm a bit goofy for having an interest in UFOs and ghosts? And I think he finally got the point. And the point to me is, you know, we sort of, the materialist world that we live in now, it's become very sort of de rigueur to just dismiss all of this stuff. And I understand why. Because religion has gotten, and deservedly so, a bad name over the course of human history. But you should be able to separate religion, organized religion, from what's actually out there. Call it spirituality, call it faith, call it philosophy, if you will.
Back to a point that you mentioned a little bit ago, one of the things that you run into when you deal with the paranormal or when you try and wrap your arms around spirituality or whatever is beyond, as you're saying, is, as you just mentioned, the extent to which it is intentionally obscured by our culture or by certain groups within our culture that see it as being in their benefit to direct things in a certain way. I thought it was refreshing that you don't seem to engage too much in that we got to beat the skeptics and they're out to get us kind of thing, which is great. But at the same time, as a filmmaker, what do you think is your obligation to, I guess, bring people closer to stripping away maybe some of those preconceived ideas they may have to reveal a deeper truth that has been intentionally obscured from our view?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the obligation is to present the information. So take the Friedman film, for instance. In Stanton T. Friedman is Real, you obviously have Stan telling his life story, talking about the things that he believes in, that he considers true. I give not quite equal time, but I gave Vaughn Rees, who was with the Center for Scientific Inquiry, which was part of PSYCOP, Carl Flock, who was a UFO researcher, but was also very much a skeptic to the point where they called him within the UFO community a dyed-in-the-wool debunker when it came to Roswell. which is, of course, Friedman's big thing. That's the one thing that he's really hung his hat on for 35 years. You know, I gave them equal time, but I'm actually a big believer that people are smart. I think, and this is really sort of, this will be my one poke at folks on either side of the intellectual divide, the arch disbelievers and the arch believers, that Richard Dawkinses and the Tim LaHayes or whatever you want to call them. I think they have very little respect for the average human being and the ability of the average human being to look at as much information as you can give them from all different perspectives and come up with their own conclusion, which might actually be different than the one you hold, but that's fine.
Tell us what else is going on with you, with the book, The Other Side of Truth. When is it officially going to be out, and what other projects are you working on?
It's officially out now, Alex. It's available on amazon.com.co.uk. You can get it from my company's website. So it's kind of the test run, because I've started, after years of making films, I decided, you know what? I love books. So I've started a publishing company. I've been working on editing a series of new books that are going to be coming out over the next year. And I moved away from television a couple years ago and documentaries. And I moved into something that I'd always wanted to do, which was drama, theater, film. So I actually start directing a feature film script that I wrote next month. Weirdly enough, the film is a psychosexual thriller with supernatural overtones. So even when I move into dramatic work, I can't quite get away from the paranormal or the supernatural.
Great. Well, the book again, The Other Side of Truth, quite a fascinating journey as you've talked about here. Best of luck with it. And thanks again for joining me, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Good talking to you.
Thanks again to Paul for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. And there you'll also find links to a forum where you can join with other listeners and discuss this episode and previous episodes, or you can leave a comment directly there on the website. Of course, Facebook, email to me, always available there on the website as well. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, including an interview with Dr. Mario Beauregard that I think you'll enjoy. Stay with me for all of that. But until next time, take care. Bye for now.